Welcome to the Grief Dreams podcast. Thanks for tuning in. This is where we have conversations with guests about life, loss, grief, and grief dreams, which can be dreams of your loved ones that have passed away. So if you want to know more about the topic, you can definitely check out our website, griefdreams.ca, for more information. And here are four ways you can help support the podcast and help us spread awareness on this amazing topic. So number one, subscribe and rate the podcast on the platform that you listen to it on. Number two, become a member of the podcast, and that's for as low as $1.50 a month. This helps us run the podcast, and you can find the Patreon link in the show notes. Number three, you can take the Grief Dreams online course by Dr. Joshua Black at griefdreams.ca. And lastly, follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Clubhouse, and Facebook at Grief Dreams. And now on to the show.
The new beginning. Welcome to the Grief Dreams podcast. Thank you for tuning in once again. I'm your host, Dr. Joshua Black, and we have Jade Carling Black with us today. And so this is going to be an exciting episode, and let's get to it. So today we have Sage Dyer, who is a 31-year-old woman from New York City. She grew up in Florida and moved to New York, where she graduated from NYU with a master's degree in psychology. She is a co-author of the new book, The Knowing, which explores how she was able to return to the teachings of her father, Dr. Wayne Dyer, after he passed away. She has published a children's book titled Goodbye Bumps that tells the true story of how she was able to heal herself as a child through the power of the mind. Sage often traveled with her father to speak to his audiences, and she recently appeared on his PBS special. Sage is the mother to her little boy, Julian, and she enjoys traveling, learning, and spending time with loved ones. Being the youngest of eight children, family is and always has been an important part of her life. So Sage, thank you for coming on the podcast. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
One thing I always like looking at people's bios, and I knew this before because we had two of your sisters on ahead of time, but what was it like for you being the youngest of eight children? I think that, you know, when I look at that, especially from a psychological point of view, like, I wonder if there's great benefits or or great consequences that come with being the youngest of eight children.
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's probably a mix of both now that I can reflect back on my childhood a little bit. It was a lot of fun. It was always something exciting going on. I think when there's a lot of kids, it fosters a little bit more independence among your kids because they can't have all that one-on-one attention that you get when you have maybe one or two or even three kids. And so I think that that's really great. And then I think there are parts of it where it's like, I don't want to say, because I loved my childhood, I don't want to say something that makes it sound like I think I was like neglected or the victim of something. I had a great childhood. But I do think that there is a part of it where it's like the focus becomes on the older kids that have more going on. So the younger kids get just blend in, which is good for you. And also maybe, you know, you miss out on a little, but overall it was a lot of fun.
Was it hard to get like one-on-one attention with your parents? I could see that being very difficult.
You know, I never felt like it was growing up. I mean, my parents definitely did an awesome job of making us all feel loved, part of the group. I mean, I spent a lot of time with my siblings because I had so many of them. It was like built-in friends, you know, and there was just always something exciting going on. If they had friends over, I would join with them, or I had my friends over. I mean, our house was like a open door to friends, kids in the neighborhood, everybody always coming in and out. So maybe I didn't get as much one-on-one attention, but I don't think that I noticed.
That's so interesting. Yeah, because you're right. There's so much going on. So like you don't even like maybe even want to spend the time with your parents. You have all these friends and kids over and they all want to play. Oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah, definitely. And I definitely think it like I said, it creates, it fosters an independence among your kids that I think can be very healthy. And my parents, you know, because there were eight of us, I remember one of my dad's big things when he would travel on the road, he would sometimes bring back a gift for one of us or two of us. But if one of the other siblings got upset, he would always say, you know, you need to learn to be happy for each other because there's no way that I can bring home eight gifts every single time I travel on the road. But, you know, you get a gift. Sometimes your sibling gets a gift, and you need to just be happy for your sibling when they get a gift. And so that was really encouraged and expected of us at a young age of like, it's not always equal. It's not always fair, but that's okay. Be happy for the other one. And I think that that was also a healthy, you know, rule in our household from a psychology perspective.
Yeah, I can see. I'm surprised he did that, you know, personally, but, you know, good for him to teach that, because it's such a beautiful lesson to be happy for others when they get something or when they achieve a goal or something that maybe you didn't get a chance to achieve yet. And so it just teaches that and fosters more compassion and, you know, less of the desire for yourself to get everything. And so, you know, as a kid, the other thing I want to just talk about with children, I know in my life, I have three siblings, two of them are older. And just finding your way in your career path through looking at everyone around you, was that difficult at all? Because I know, like, for me, like, I went to psychology. One of the reasons was because I didn't know much about it. I was really into math. My brother was into psychology in the beginning. So I kind of followed his route in many ways, and I followed his direction, kind of. So it made it easier for me. Did you find that for yourself in the sense of, you know, doing or going to take your master's or doing other things that you were a part of?
Yeah, I mean, to a degree, yes. Like, my sister Serena, who's also my co-author, she got her master's at University of Miami. She's 5 years older than me. So when she did that, it definitely opened me up to, like, oh, well, maybe after I graduate college, I'll do a little more school. So I think I got yes on one hand, but on the other hand, like, I had so many siblings. They were all doing different things. Like, not even all my siblings decided to go to college or finish college. Some of them had more different types of career dreams. And so I think because it was so all over the map, it wasn't like everybody did the same thing. So it, like, laid a path out for me. So because it was not like that, I think that I just chose on my own. And for me also, it was wanting to move out of South Florida after I graduated college, and, like, just further my education, that called me to New York to a master's in psychology. And I was just very drawn to it. I don't think that, aside from the seed being planted when Serena went to grad school and thinking, like, oh, I could do that too. Otherwise, I think it came from just an interest in learning and an interest in, you know, living in New York.
Would you say it was a knowing?
Yeah, I mean, perhaps, because I mean, one thing we wrote about a lot in the book was surrendering to life as it's presented to you, and going with the flow as opposed to, like, fighting up the current, going with the flow of life, taking the path of least resistance. There's a part in the book we write about when I was growing up, I was with my dad in the car one time, and that song, I Hope You Dance by Leanne Womack, it came on the radio. You probably have heard it. It's like a lot of cliche lines. I hope you never fear those mountains in the distance. I hope you dance, and on and on. I remember my dad said, I agree with every single line in that song except for one, and can you figure out which one it is? So we listened to the song, and I don't remember if I got it right or not, but what he said after the song was over is there's a line that says, I hope you never settle for the path of least resistance. And he said, every line in that song is beautiful except that one, because you should always take the path of least resistance. You know, when the universe is offering you resistance, it's perhaps for a reason, and you should step back. And on the other hand, when the universe is offering you, you know, all green lights and go, you know, just the energy to move forward, that you should go with that. And when it was time for me to apply to grad school and move to New York, it was very much the path of least resistance. It was all green lights. I want to move to New York. One of my best friends her roommate was moving out. Okay, I have a place to live. I got into NYU, even though I missed the deadline for the application. Another green light. And it, you know, on and on and on from there. So it's an example in my life of when the universe is presenting an opportunity to move forward, to go with it. And it worked out for me. I ended up, you know, I met my husband up here. We started a business. I wrote a book up here. I now have a child, another one on the way, which, sorry if I sound out of breath, but I'm 9 months pregnant, so it's always hard to catch my breath. And my life unfolded, and happiness, you know, I found a happiness up here that I was missing in South Florida.
Wow. Incredible. I'll just say sometimes the path of least resistance gives me hives. And personally speaking, you sound very grounded in that sentiment. And I resonate with the feeling of the green lights, but when I have followed the path of least resistance, I've also, and maybe you share this, but I've also had these like overwhelming feelings of like fear, even though everything's kind of like lining up. So did you ever have those moments and then it was kind of overpowered by the presence of green lights? Like when you were moving or leading up, did you have like those bouts of kind of doubt?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely had moments of doubt. I had lived in South Florida my whole life. I was 22 years old, ready to pick up and move. And yeah, of course, there were times where I thought, is this the best idea? Is this the right move for me? But I would just remind myself that I could always move back and, you know, that nothing's permanent. And and it's more reflecting back on it that I can see that it was the path of least resistance. At the time, it was just flowing and going so well. It was, you know, one thing after the other, making it so easy for me to move up there. But I still had my moments of fear and doubt. And it also isn't to say that that's not the path of least resistance does not mean a lack of hard work or commitment or dedication. It's not that at all. You know, hard work is great, and dedication and motivation and inspiration, all of those things are part of getting what you want in life. But it's more just this idea of like, it wasn't, you know, if I had said I want to move to New York and everything went wrong, I think it would have been an opportunity for me to question like, okay, maybe this isn't the right move. Maybe I need to wait a little while. And
I totally relate to that. I also had a big move and also had lots of green lights along the way. And I think the more green lights that came, the more like, it sounds counterintuitive, but scared I became, like almost like, oh, this is too easy. Or you have like, you know, those personal signs that you know, okay, this is really happening and this is really meant to happen. And so for me, it was kind of like an ebb and flow of like, this feels easy in a sense, but in the same breath, I'm a little bit afraid that it's this easy or happening. The progression is going in a relatively smooth kind of course. So interesting, because I think a lot of people have those kind of nudges, and then there's the, even though like the universe is kind of trying to guide you in a certain direction, you know, some people don't go at all or like shut that down kind of thing. So that's interesting that you, you know, found a pot of gold on the other side, and really cool. So do any of your other siblings, does everyone live in South Florida, or are you the only one that went out of state?
Yeah, I'm the only one who lives in New York. Majority of my siblings live in South Florida, but I have a brother in Hawaii, a brother, a sister in Minneapolis, and a sister in Costa Rica. So we're a little all over the place, but the rest of everybody is, and my mom are all in South Florida.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I love what you're saying, but just going with the flow. And that, for me, it's also finding out where the resistance is so you can pivot and to be okay with change. And that was something on my path I had to do, just even research this topic, because I wanted to be an elementary school teacher. And then, you know, when I had to book this interview to get in, there was just something of just saying no. And so there's this resistance to doing something I've basically trained my whole life to do. And I had to trust that feeling. And then I pivoted, and I didn't know where I was pivoting, but it turned out to be this, and researching the topic, which I'm so grateful for. But at that moment, I was just trusting sort of this knowing or this feeling that this is not the right path anymore that once was. Now, I always think that's interesting too. So like, do you see that in your own life too, where it's like you have this, you're able to pivot a little bit better now because you have this knowledge?
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely try to notice in the moment when I'm being offered resistance and when I'm resisting that resistance and stop myself. Because as I've gotten a little bit older and I've just reflected back, I've had more opportunities to reflect back on things in my life where I can see that, you know, the resistance or the red lights were there for a reason. And when I pushed, it often didn't benefit me, versus when I flow, you know, not only is life a little bit simpler, you're often given rewards that you never expected. So I try to remember that, you know, with everything. I mean, I could give another example. When I found out I was pregnant with my son, you know, my husband and I were married. We had been married for a year. I just graduated from grad school. I was 29. So I was in a place to have a baby, and I knew what I was doing. I mean, I'm not going to pretend to be stupid. I knew what was going on and the risks or whatever that we were taking. But when I actually found out that I was pregnant, I was terrified. And I was like, oh my God, what did I do? You know, not in a way that, you know, and I get that to some people might sound, you know, like I was being ungrateful, because there are people who struggle to get pregnant, and here I was in a good place and able to get pregnant easily, but I couldn't help it. Even when I told myself that, I felt so scared, and I felt like I was grieving sort of the life that I was about to leave behind, and I was in my head a lot about, like, my life is over. I kept telling myself that I could never have a career, and, you know, on and on and on, that my life would just never be the same. I was going to be stuck inside an apartment. I could never travel again. So many things. This is what was running through my mind. It wasn't until I recognized that what I was doing, and that I was choosing these thoughts, and that I could choose a different, you know, a different thought process here, which is that this is a blessing. This is exciting. Of course it's new, it's going to be change, but it's going to be beautiful change. And I love kids, and I always wanted to have kids. So, you know, I knew that this would be something that would bring me happiness. And even if I couldn't fully know it and at the time, it just being open to the idea that it would be a beautiful thing, and being open to changing my thought process, started to make it a beautiful thing for me. And you know, the other ironic part of it too was that I kept thinking that I had 9 months until I could never have a career. I thought, once I have a baby, any career I wanted to have is done. So getting pregnant is what pushed me to push me, myself, and my sister Serena to finish writing this book, hire a literary agent, and get it to a publisher, because I thought I have a ticking time bomb inside of me. And it turns out none of that was true. I had my son, and I can still very much have a career, which is great. But, you know, he served that purpose in my life. And at first I was resisting it so hard, and it was silly, because I'm so happy. My son is the love of my life. I have more of a career than I even thought I would have prior to getting pregnant. And it all started to unfold when I stopped resisting the circumstance I was in.
Beautiful reflections. I really resonate with that fear of, like, my life is over and I'll never have a career. It's like really all or nothing kind of thinking. But I think, you know, and people always outside of me too, when I was pregnant and had all those same, it's like you're kind of in my head, because I had lots of those same, my life is over, my academic career is done, and it's just basically, yeah, I'm going to be in my apartment or whatever, and that's going to be the extent of it, which is, you know, again, unrealistic and hasn't been my journey at all. But it's, I think a lot of people tell you too, like, you know, your whole, people give lots of scary thoughts around, like, people always told me your life is over, you're not going to do the same things. And ironically enough, it was older women a lot. Like people at the grocery store in the line, it'd be older, like, women and, like, just strangers and stuff too. And life's never going to be the same. And I hope you're getting, you know, I hope you got good sleep before, and, like, those kind of comments. So I don't think the general narrative really helped me a lot in the feasibility of, like, juggling both things. But I like that you landed on that it absolutely is possible. And in fact, the career piece seems to be even more enjoyable and bigger than you had imagined. So that's a delightful surprise.
Yeah, no, it's been such a rewarding experience getting to, I mean, I'm blessed that the career that I'm living and have chosen doesn't require me to have a 9-to-5. So I very much get to raise my son and be home with him almost all the time, but I also get to, you know, come into my bedroom and do these awesome interviews and and we wrote a book and get to, you know, I feel like I'm so blessed in the life that I have. I get to have a career. I get to be a mom, and anyone can do that. But for me, it took surrendering to this path that the universe had presented to me to get to that place of recognizing, you know, the universe had a better plan for me than what I had. And it didn't unfold until I surrendered, accepted, and just went with the flow. And, you know, how beautiful it has all turned out for me at this point.
Yeah, I think this is not, and it's not the first time you changed your perspective. I know you wrote a book that you sort of mentioned, Goodbye Bumps, that was really based on changing your perspective on an event. And it definitely not only it can change your life in the sense of how you approach the event, but for you, it actually changed your healing. So I wonder if you like talk about that. I know you talked about it in your book, and I was just fascinated by that and how young you were being able to approach something like that. So could you tell that story?
Yeah, for sure. So when I was about 5 years old, I developed a rash on my face of bumps. And my parents, after a few weeks, they took me to the doctor, and it didn't seem like anything to be worried about. Kids get rashes, whatever. But after a few weeks, it didn't go away. So they took me to the doctor, and the doctor diagnosed it quickly and easily as flatwarts. And he said that flatwarts are common in kids, and they're nothing to worry about generally, and they should go away on their own within, you know, a month or so. And so that was that. I made my parents promise that they would not tell my siblings that I had warts on my face, because I had a feeling that could invite some teasing. So that's where they got the name Bumps. I called them my bumps. And so, you know, we went home and sort of forgot about it. And anyway, long story short, they did not go away after a month. And about a year or so later, they were still on my face, and my parents decided to take me back to the doctor. My parents were not big into, they really believed in the power of the body to heal. So they wanted to give me ample time to heal, but it wasn't happening. And they were becoming more obvious on my face because my skin would tan and they wouldn't. So anyway, they took me back to the doctor, and the doctor said that we could treat them because they had been on my face for so long. But he laid out two treatment options. One was freeze drying or burning them off. And I was like six at this point, and that didn't sound very appealing to a six-year-old, burning things off of my face. And he said the other option would be to take a medication, an oral medication that could cause all kinds of side effects, like your face would turn red and it would peel and it may or may not work and you have to stay out of the sun and, you know, so many things. And that also didn't sound very appealing to me as a six-year-old. So I said to my parents, I don't want to do either of those things. And they said, okay. And they talked to the doctor, and the doctor said, you know, they're not hurting her. We can continue to wait. So we did. And then about like another year and a half, they were still on my face. They were still having gotten worse. You know, no healing had taken place. And this time my parents decided to take me to a dermatologist. We were out in Maui, which is where my dad lived, and as a family we went there every summer, and he had a dermatologist out there who was also a good friend. So they took me to him, and he sort of said the same thing as the doctor. He said, as the pediatrician that I had seen before, he said, you have two treatment options, and at this point we really should treat them because they've been on your face for so long and it doesn't seem like they are going to go away. So he said something about your immune system's not kicking in, on and on. So I said to my parents, you know, I really still don't want to burn them off or take any medicine. We were in Hawaii. I didn't want to have to stay out of the sun. So then I said, okay, hang on. Give us a second. We're going to go talk to the doctor outside in the hallway. So my parents left the room with the doctor, and then they came back a few minutes later, and they said, okay, you know what? We decided that we think you have a third option. And they said that the third option is that you could heal yourself of these bumps, that you could actually talk to them and they'll listen and you could make them go away. And I looked at the doctor and he was like, okay, I guess that's your third option. And so I left and I said, I'm going with option number three. And we went home that day, and later that night I got into bed and I talked to my bumps literally in my head for about 5 minutes before I fell asleep. And I did that again for 3 nights in a row. And on the fourth night, I got in bed and I went to talk to my bumps, and they were completely gone. Like, I don't remember what they looked like, because at that age, you don't look in the mirror very much, or at least I didn't. But I remember what they felt like, and I remember just never feeling like I had smooth skin. So on the fourth night, when I got in bed to talk to my bumps, I reached up to touch my face, and they were completely gone. There wasn't any bumpiness. So I ran out of my bed and into my parents' bed, and I was so excited, and I said, "They're gone, they're gone, they're gone." And they were like, "What's gone? What are you talking about?" And I was like, "My bumps, they're gone, look." And my dad, I remember he pulled me up close to him and was like, "Oh my God, they're gone. I don't see any." And my mom came in, she, you know, they couldn't believe it. It was just 4 nights later. And my dad looked at me and said, "What did you say to them?" And I said, "It's a secret." And he started to tickle me and was like, "No, you got to tell me what you said to them." And I wouldn't tell him. And it became, I think, you know, I was enjoying the attention and whatever. I would not tell him what I said to them, and he was bribing me, saying, "I'll take you for ice cream, I'll give you $20. He was like, "This is material for my work, you've got to tell me." And I said, "I can't, it's a secret." And that went on for a long time that I did not tell him. However,
you kept wanting him to raise the fee, right? Yeah, $20 isn't enough. Yeah.
Right. And eventually he stopped asking, and about 10 years later it came up. And I was thinking, like, why haven't I told them what I said to them? I was like 18 years old at this point. I said, I'll tell you what I said to my mom. I don't know why I didn't tell you for so long. And I said, what I told them was that I loved them, but that we couldn't be together anymore, that they couldn't stay on my face, and that I pictured myself having clear skin. I asked them to leave nicely. I continually told them that I loved them, but asked them to leave. I pictured them falling off onto the sidewalk, you know, and I told them, you know, we could still be together in other ways, but they couldn't be on my face. And this is all in the voice of a child, an 8-year-old, but I did it from love. And nobody had told me what to say. And I think, so when I told my dad that, he was very moved, and he immediately called the dermatologist, because when this all happened, the dermatologist was like, "Oh my God, well, what did she say? This is phenomenal." You know, he's like, I know that she's had them for years, and they just are gone in a day and in a few days. I mean, so he called him right on the spot to tell him she finally told me what she said to her bumps. And he actually started crying on the phone, because he said, "I imagined that she would have threatened these bumps and, you know, waged war with them. If you don't leave, I'm going to burn you off," on and on. But I didn't. I told them that I loved them, and I asked them to leave, and I pictured myself with clear skin, and it was simple. And I think that the reason that it worked and that it was so simple is because, you know, as a child, having my parents tell me that I could heal myself of these bumps was enough of a reason for me to wholeheartedly believe that I could. You know, it's different when you're older and somebody might tell you that, and you'd be like, "I don't know. Sounds a little goofy. Like, maybe I'll try it for a couple days, but if it doesn't work, I'm going to have to go back to the doctor." But at my young age, in my own simple way, I just knew that it would work. I had no doubt. I believed it, and I did it from love. And I think those were the two big ingredients, the keys that I try to remember now, because I don't know that it would come so simply to me now. You know, even though I did this, I think it being a child had a lot to do with why it worked for me. But I think we can do it as adults. It just takes a different level of commitment.
Amazing. Amazing that your parents encouraged you to have that conversation with yourself and even presented a third option. That's so beautiful. That's a conversation. It's a really, I'm like speechless. That's like amazing that you have that to be able to experience those prompts, basically, is what I'm getting at. Things that, you know, lots of people don't have. Lots of parents wouldn't present that third option, and how empowering that is, and how that's likely set the stage for other wins in your life as you've grown up, even if it is more difficult to like employ those things now. And then the reflection on the loving way, talking in the loving way, and allowing that to be kind of the centerpiece of that whole experience and stuff. It's really cool. I just want to tell you, I love the book. I love the illustrations. I've been reading it with my daughter, and you know, she's three, so I don't know how much of it, you know, but she's listening, and it's definitely the book that stands out in our toddler book collection, and no other subject matter quite like that. So thank you for just putting that experience into a book, and it's just really beautifully done and really cool learning experience to read. And I hope that I can, you know, relay those same kind of sentiments to, you know, my kids and encourage them to have that. And not only for them, for myself too. And, you know, the people that I love, like just framing it up in that way when something's bugging you is really brings lots of rewards.
Yeah, no, it's empowering to have. I think that it's important for parents to empower their children in that way, because the power of belief, I mean, the placebo effect, it's a real thing, you know. So it's, especially anybody who studies psychology knows that. I mean, my dad used to, he said one of the pivotal moments in his life, a life-changing thing that happened for him, was when he was in grad school and they did an experiment where they blindfolded other students, and they took like a sewing needle, just a thin piece of metal, and they put it in freezing cold water. So, but they told the blindfolded student that they were burning, that they were putting it in fire, that it was going to be searing hot. And they took the freezing cold needle and they placed it on the person's skin. Not, they didn't poke them. They just placed it along their skin on their arm. And the people who were told that it was going to be searing hot, they formed blisters. They formed a blister. It got all red and a blister formed as if they had been burned. But they hadn't. It was actually just very, very cold. And you know, without knowledge, freezing cold and burning hot on something as small as a pin can feel very similar. So the belief that they got burnt was enough for their body to form a blister. And my dad said he watched that, and it was a pivotal moment in his life, was just the power of the mind, the power of the thoughts that we choose that create our reality, both in a mental and emotional state, but also literally in your physical body. You have the ability to impact, you know, how you react physically to things. It's mental just as much as it is physical. So I always remember that experiment. I didn't see it with my own eyes, but I know what a big impact it had on my dad, and it does equally to me too.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's amazing. I learned about the placebo when I was in grad school too, and it completely floored me, because then I learned about, so the placebo is like the positive effects from like a fake drug. The nocebo is the negative effects from a fake drug, which a lot of people don't talk about. They usually just talk about the positive aspects. But like, as you're saying, like in the experiment, that's the negative aspects. And what does that mean as we move forward in our own lives and how we look at things? And I love how your story really talks about, with the bumps, the power of love and, you know, setting boundaries. I think that's just a great story for any adult looking to break up with someone or just change the way they do things if they're addicted to something or whatnot. I think there's a lot of truth in that, to how we approach that separation. Because a lot of times, you're right, people try to fight against what they don't want rather than loving it and understanding that it exists and just taking it with them in a different way, either as a story or as a memory, as they sort of do something else with it. And you have, right? And like, you didn't lie to it. Like, here you are talking about it. It's a legend in the game of books, children's books. And so it actually became very popular because of believing you, right? That you didn't lie. You didn't lie. Like, it changed. You carried it with you. So I think that's kind of cool. And so, you know, as we go forward, let's talk about your grief a little bit and how you found, since we're talking about surrendering and changing, how you, I guess, experienced the death of your father, and then how you're able to surrender to, I think, the changes, because you wrote a book on it and it's really about a lot of the stuff you've learned from it. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, for sure. My dad passed away suddenly in August of 2015. He was not sick, and it was unexpected. I had just been with him traveling on a three-week tour through Australia and New Zealand, where he was, speaking, doing all-day lectures and multiple times throughout the 3 weeks. And he was so full of life, and you would have never thought that he was sick or in his final weeks in any sort of physical way. And so when I found out that he had passed away, I was definitely blindsided. I had never lost anybody that I was close to in that way before. I had lost my grandparents, which was, sad, but it wasn't earth-shattering the way that losing my father was. And when he initially passed away, I was raised on his philosophies and my mother's as well. They constantly talked about how death is an illusion. It's just on to the next great adventure. My dad would regularly talk about how he looked forward to what came next, the next phase, if you will, how it's just a shift in energy, on and on. So I was raised around these ideas. And I'm not going to say I did not believe in them. They didn't apply to me. And when I would think about any of these sorts of things that my parents would talk about, I was maybe a little bit skeptical. I would call myself like a skeptic and a believer, but the bigger thing is that they just did not apply to me. So it didn't really matter. I didn't dwell on it because I hadn't lost anybody I loved. I wasn't worried about my own death. So it's not something I thought a lot about. So after my dad passed, I felt like I was at sort of a crossroads of like, okay, am I going to view this as the final, the end, my relationship with my dad is over, and I just have to deal with, that sort of loss and grief and move on? Or am I going to see this as an opportunity to get to know him in a different way and to dive into his work that now applies to me in such a big way when it didn't before? And I can remember there was a moment that I was in the shower in the, in the early days after he had passed away. And this had happened a lot where I would get really overcome with grief and unable to control my sobs and, just overwhelmed. And then I would have this thought of just call dad. And then I would have to realize that I would not ever do that again. And it would be like this devastation all over again. And after doing that several times, it happened again when I was in the shower one time, and I thought, okay, so you can't go down, you can't keep going down this road of it's gonna eat away at you. I'm torturing myself with these kinds of thoughts. So I said, okay, you can't call dad, you'll never call dad again, but you have a lifetime of knowing him and learning from him and speaking with him about everything under the sun. What would he say to you in this moment? What would be his advice? And I felt like I sort of had a moment with him there in the shower where I could hear him saying to me, you could either make this the worst thing that ever happened to you, you could feel sorry for yourself, you could choose to not, because this was August 30th, my semester was starting September like 3rd or 4th, just a few days later, right after Labor Day. And I could hear him saying, you could choose not to go back to school this semester, and you could feel bad for yourself, and that would be okay. And that's not to say that that's not okay for somebody who chooses to do that, because grief is real, and it's important to feel the sadness. But for me, it was too much all the time, So I felt like he said, or you could just view this as an opportunity to get to know me from the other side, to grow, to help people, to learn, to expand your consciousness, and to wholeheartedly believe and know that death is, we are neither birthless nor deathless, that this is not the end. It's just an end to the physical. And that there's, to if you dig deeper within yourself, you can still connect with your loved ones. You can still you can carry them with you in a way. If you believe it, if you know it, it can just be a different experience. And so, and I felt like I was being presented with those two choices. And I was reminded of this story in that moment that he had frequently told when I had been with him in Australia and New Zealand just a few weeks before that, where it was the story of a man who his son was at war, and he got a knock on his door one day where he was told that his son had died in battle. And that night he went into the town and he was dancing at a party. And this woman came up to him because it was a small town and everybody knew that he had just found out his son had passed away. So she came up to him and said, "I just don't understand how you could be here dancing when you just learned that your son passed away." And he said, "Sooner or later, I'm going to have to move on from this or it's going to kill me. And I'm just choosing sooner." And I felt like I was reminded of that story, you know, for a reason, that it was divine, because like I said, it's important to feel your grief. And I'm not saying that you should just get over it in a day and be dancing. It's a metaphor for it's okay also to feel your grief, but at the same time to choose sooner, to choose to be happy at times when you can be. And I felt like I was almost given permission in that moment, like, yes, I can go back to school next week, even though that feels too soon. If it's what I want to do, I can choose that. And I can choose to feel joy in moments and feel sadness in other moments. And I can choose to make this an opportunity. You know, I can choose. I can choose. I just started to feel like empowered by the situation. And it was a big pivotal moment for me. That moment in the shower, those few moments in the shower where I felt like wisdom came to me out of nowhere, and it was my dad like communicating with me. And it set me on this path that eventually led to this book, because being open to this idea that my dad didn't, his soul did not end or die when his body died, led me to being open to signs from him and communications from him and just a whole other world that I had been previously closed off to.
Wow, that's amazing. And it's amazing, I think, how you brought up a really great point of feeling empowered in your grief journey, where a lot of times, I think, you know, I had it after my dad died, where you feel powerless to not only the circumstances that they're gone, but also your emotions. And it's really nice, as you were saying, that you can, there is a different way where you're not taking away the pain, but you're just finding ways to be more empowered on the journey. And that, as I said, it takes you in a lot of different directions. And you wrote this book, and I think that's amazing. And congratulations for writing that and to do it with your sister. So like, I don't know if I could do one with my siblings. I don't know what that book would look like, because we have so many different ideas. So I'm really curious, when you're writing your book and hearing her side of her grief, I'm guessing it was different from you, to really put those together, was that difficult at all? Like, were there stories that just they didn't match up and you couldn't find chapters for?
Yeah, so that was difficult. And that's sort of what took us. So, because what happened initially was we were not writing a book together. We were just both writing. And I found myself being called to write in the early months and year after my dad passed away. I was just spending a lot of time writing. Even though I was in grad school and I had so many papers to write and things like that, I still was making the time to write what I eventually realized could be a book. And Serena was doing the same thing, and we didn't even fully know it. And then we were talking one day, and we're talking with a friend who's also an author, and she said, "Why would you guys, if you're both going to write books, don't put out competing books, do something together?" And we thought, oh, we never thought of that. And we realized, so we took a look at each other's work and realized that it actually fit together quite well. I mean, it took a lot of time, effort, and work to make it fit together. And obviously, you know, I didn't write my parts in the third person, and neither did she. So there was like a lot of rewriting and conversion of things to make it be a sort of a universal voice in the book, because we were told by publishing companies and on that it would be confusing to have it switch between our two voices in the I form. So anyway, that's just technical stuff, but it was cool that it did work out where our books and our writing did come together in a way. There were seams that we didn't even realize existed until we really took a look and decided to put it out together.
Yeah, I think it's amazing because you both also had books with your father also. So to come together, it's pretty interesting just to see that from my point of view. You're the two that then produced this other book from his teachings. And so I'm curious, along the way, did you ever have any dreams of your father?
Yeah, I had a lot of dreams and I still have a lot of dreams. And after a while, I could sort of fit them into different categories, which is why I said yes to your podcast, because I think this topic is really fascinating. Especially in the early days, I had a lot of dreams where I would be finding my dad and he would still be alive, and I'd be convincing him that he didn't have to die, or coming up with some last-minute invention to save him, you know, saying, if you just aren't alone at this time, then I'll be able to call 911, and things like that, that were definitely grief-driven dreams for me. And I think those are common. Also dreams where I was angry at him, dreams where he would show up and then disappear and I wouldn't be able to find him, just dreams that were more stressful than anything. And I had those all the time. I don't really have them anymore. But I had one dream of my dad that truly felt like a visitation. And I have actually no doubt in my mind that it was. Basically, in my dream, I was in my apartment. I lived in a studio apartment at the time in New York. And so the door to our apartment was right next to my bed. And I was sleeping in my bed in real life, and my alarm went off. And I decided to hit snooze because I was tired. And I went, so I hit snooze, and I immediately went back into a dream. I immediately went back to sleep, and I was immediately also dreaming. And in my dream, I was in exactly the same place I was in real life. I was laying in my bed in my apartment, looking at my phone. And as I'm doing that, I hear my door open to my apartment. So I sit up and I look around the wall corner, and it's my dad walking in. And he's got like a grin on his face. And so I got out of my bed and I ran up to him and I said, I know that I'm asleep, but this isn't a dream. And he said, it's not a dream. You're right. This is real. And I said, you're really here, aren't you? And he said, I'm really here. And I said, I became skeptical in that moment. I said, okay, if you're really here, then I could touch you. And he said, so touch me. And he put his arms out and I grabbed his arms with my hands. And I could feel them in my dream. I could feel his hairy arms the way they felt in real life. And in that moment, I dropped my skepticism and I hugged him. And then we talked and it was just like a beautiful 10 minutes. And then my alarm went off and then I was awake again. And I reflected. I mean, I carried that dream with me I couldn't shake the feeling for weeks. I was telling everyone about it because I was like, you guys, it wasn't a dream. It was real. Like, my dad was in my apartment. And I was actually talking to a long story of how it happened, but I ended up talking to a woman named Karen Noe, who's a psychic medium and studies this stuff as well. And she said to me, before I told her about my dream, she said, you will know you're having a visitation from a loved one if two things happen. If it's lucid dreaming, where it's like you're aware that you're dreaming, and if there's an acknowledgement or an invitation of touch. And I was like, Karen, I just had a dream like that, and I can't stop telling everyone about it. And those two exact things happened in my dream. And, you know, so she was very excited. And I felt validated by that because I hadn't told her what it was. And those were like the two biggest things I kept saying to everybody. Like, I knew I was asleep, but I knew it wasn't a dream. And then there was this moment of where we touched. And so that was really cool. And then that was probably a month after he passed away. I continue to have dreams of my dad all the time. They're usually a dream. They're no longer these grief dreams where I am angry at him or I'm finding him and it turns out he was just in another country and he's back or things like that. But I do have dreams where we're just enjoying each other. It's, you know, just a normal old memory of being with my dad.
That's so beautiful. I'm happy you had, first of all, that powerful dream from all the negative ones you're having, because that, you know, that causes you so much distress when you wake up. And I'm guessing people in your family were having positive dreams because they've been on the podcast sharing the positive dreams they had of your father, and you're having like these negative ones. For you to finally have one of these very beautiful, comforting ones, they said that you couldn't even believe you had. Like, you were telling everyone, like, like it's such an amazing moment. I'm really, oh, I'm just so, it's so beautiful when I hear those dreams and how it can help people move through the grief journey. And to just sort of solidify something that I said, like, you're trying to figure out in waking life. And that just gave you that moment where you're like, yep, you know, like, I truly believe this.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I was, like I said, I was in the early days after my dad passed, I was in this place where I felt like I was choosing, am I going to be skeptical or am I going to believe, you know? And as I began to open up to the beliefs, the knowing that he was still with me, then I had a dream like that, you know, then I experienced other really synchronistic moments or signs from him, but it was first choosing to believe that he was still with me, to know that he was still with me, and that his death was just, you know, simply a shift. He used to say, when I'm gone, you just think of me as being in the other room, and that it was that, you know, that I can still call out to him. I can't see him because he's in the other room, but that I can still know that he's there. And it was that shift of knowing that, that I believe opened me up to the possibility of a dream like that and to all the other things that, you know, I just said.
Hey, I'm glad too. So like you had the criteria that fit that person's category of when it is a visitation. I know we've had a ton of people on the podcast that wouldn't fit in with what the individual said. And it's based on a lot of other things. So I just want to, if someone's listening, I don't really feel that those are the categories. I think it's something just in your heart that you know when it is and when it isn't. Because, you know, like as I said, people on the podcast, they don't touch. And I don't see that often, tell you the truth, touching with the different categories I've seen. But at the end of the day, it's so variable. It's just so much to go through. Anyways, so I think it's amazing. And just thank you for sharing that with us. And so as we're just wrapping up the podcast, if you could have a dream tonight of your father, what would that dream look like to you?
You know, and just to comment on what you just said, I agree. I don't think that the, you know, who knows what are the rules, and it sounds like you would know more than anyone because you've studied this. For me, it was just validation hearing that from her. Because that happened to be the experience I had, but I agree. I don't think it has to involve touch or anything like that. It was just very cool for me to hear that from someone who I knew and respected. So, but if I could have a dream, I mean, the biggest thing that, you know, that I miss about my dad, to so many people, he was this big time teacher on the stage, all of that. But what people probably don't know that aren't his kids or his family is that my dad was just so much fun and so funny. I mean, it was always, he was always teasing, but in a fun way. And it was, he had this energy about him that was sort of addicting. Like, he just drew you in. You wanted to be around him. He was somebody that drew people in. And when you were loved by him, you were so loved. And if I could have a dream about him, it would just be hanging out with him in our family home on Maui and ordering in takeout. And just, you know, I used to watch a lot of my siblings. I was the youngest, so they would go out at night and whatever. And we would always stay in and have movie nights and order food, just me and him. And I would just do that again and just have fun and feel his loving energy that I do still feel that I get to feel. But to do it in person would be amazing and in a dream, where you feel like it's in person, you know. But that's what I would want to dream about.
That's beautiful. I'm surprised you didn't say on stage where he's telling the Inception story of how you became.
No, we could skip over that story. I do write about it in the book because I had to for the story to make sense. But yes, those are some of the more embarrassing moments that I have with my dad.
Well, I just want you to know too that I'm really enjoying the book, and I just got it in the mail, so I'm about three chapters in, but I'm just finding it so enjoyable, and the stories are beautiful, and I'm just I'm so touched by it and so interested in it, and just find all your experiences and the way that you and Serena have written it to be beautiful. I know it's going to help a lot of people in trusting that knowing and, you know, feeling confident in their ability to use those kind of knowings as prompts to move here or there, and, you know, with confidence and trust and all those things that we need to move forward. So thanks for putting the book out to the world, and thanks for coming on the podcast and sharing that beautiful dream. And I just get chills hearing it. Like, I that's so beautiful to have that moment, and such a sweet, simple moment, and really cool. I love when people share those experiences, and just really awesome. So thank you for taking the time to come on and talk to us and all the listeners about your experience and your dreams.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me. This was great. I enjoyed it very much, and I love the topic. So yeah, it was a big treat for me.
Yeah, I said, like, what can I add to that? It's just it's an amazing conversation. I love your energy and just how you approach topics, especially with grief. And you really shared, like, within the book a lot about your own loss and your struggle. And I really love the honesty about that, because I feel we need to be honest about our shortcomings in life, our pain, to allow people to normalize their pain that they're going through. And so often, as you can sort of see with a lot of stuff on the internet and everything, it's people don't go deep, and you're able to go deep. And I want to just thank you for that, because that's what changes the world.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, no, I agree. I think it's important if you're going to put something out there, it needs to be honest and vulnerable, you know, if you're really going to help people, because otherwise it's not relatable. So thank you for acknowledging that.
All right. So where can people find this book, your other book, you, your platform?
Yeah, you know, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, hopefully your local bookstore. I have a website, sagedyer.com. My name is spelled with a J. My parents wanted to make my life more difficult, so it's sagedyer.com. And otherwise, you know, Instagram, Facebook. My sister's name is Serena Dyer. We're both out there. We love to connect with everybody and anybody.
All right. Amazing. And Serena's episode, if they want to go back and listen to it, was episode 76 on this. And then your other sister, Sky, was episode 70. So if you want to know the family really well, just keep clicking on these episodes. So once again, so thank you so much, Sage, for coming on. As we like to say at the end of our podcast, with love and gratitude from us to you. Thank you again for listening to the episode. We hope you enjoyed it. If you want to learn more about the topic, please check out our platform at griefdreams.ca. On there, you can find our two online courses. So the first one is a Grief Dreams workshop that I developed, which is designed to help you learn all about the topic. And the second one is Crazy in Love, Using Romantic Relationships as a Vehicle for Growth. And this is designed to help you rethink modern intimate relationships. And that is by myself and Jade Carling Black. On the website, you can also book a one-on-one Grief Dreams consulting session with me to discuss your own dreams, or if you want to learn more about the topic. You can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Clubhouse, at Grief Dreams. We have two clubs on Clubhouse that you can follow, and those are Grief Dreams, and the other one is Grief Cafe. If you have Facebook, you can follow our Grief Dreams podcast page to be notified when we release new episodes. You can also join the Grief Dreams Facebook group, and on there you can share your dreams and hear more dreams of others. Once again, to help support the podcast, please subscribe and rate the podcast on your platform that you listen on. This helps our show come up when people search for grief podcasts to listen to. Also, you can become a member of the podcast through Patreon, and we have three membership levels, $1.50, $7, and $20 a month. So if you want to give, please go there to see what perks we have to offer. This money helps us run the podcast. You can find the Patreon link in the show notes below. We would like to thank all of those who continue to support us. Thanks again for listening, and we hope you can be comforted by your dreams tonight.